I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this fall, Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley sent an email saying, "We need to move away from a system that results in too many law school graduates twisting in the wind at risk for defaulting on federal loans." That, he said, wasn't good for graduates or the taxpayers. He was referring to a report by the advocacy group Law School Transparency that claimed that too many law schools are accepting students with lower LSAT and GPA scores at risk for not passing the bar exam. Those scores have declined in recent years, and so have the number of law school applicants. Rather than having small classes, the group says, law schools have lowered their standards to keep their tuition numbers up. Needless to say, this report has caused quite a stir. And today on Radio Times, we discuss the state of law schools and the legal profession. Kyle McEntee joins us, co-founder and executive director of Law School Transparency. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Also with us, and in fact, with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Roger Dennis. He's founding dean of the Thomas R. Klein School of Law at Drexel University. A couple of years ago, he was elected to the Council of the American Bar Association Section of Legal Education and Admissions to the Bar. Roger Dennis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests, we have Jordan Weissman. He's Slate's senior business and economics correspondent, also one of the hosts of the weekly podcast Slate Money. Jordan Weissman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let me begin with you, if I could, Kyle, and begin with some of the findings in this report that came out. What evidence do you have that law schools are lowering their standards?
Sure. So there is a correlation between the LSAT and your likelihood of passing the bar exam. And so we looked at that relationship and then analyzed schools to see which were going too far in terms of who was taking too great of a chance at too great of a price for those students.
So you're seeing lower scores and fewer people passing the bar? You're finding, in a sense, a kind of a cause and effect there?
Exactly.
And is this across the board when you look at law schools?
Sure. It's across the board in the sense of the relationship, but only about a third of schools, which is a minority of schools, of course, that are going too far. We think the other schools are doing a good job at managing enrollment, and that they need to come together and speak out against the schools that are sullying the reputation of the legal profession.
What you're saying really is that, and I think this is almost a quote here, is that law schools are padding classes with unqualified students. Can you explain that to us in more detail?
Yeah. So law school is expensive. It's really expensive. And people who go and spend 3 years of time and money on attendance, they should have a good shot of actually being able to accomplish what they set out to do. And it's not necessarily getting a great job. It's just the minimal ask of passing the licensing exam.
And I do want to get to that. Let me get you in on the conversation, Roger Dennis. Do you see it this way? And you're the dean at Drexel University's law school. Is the law school accepting people that have lower scores?
Actually, no. This year, our LSAT and GPA at the 25th, 75th, and 50th percentile was up in each of those six criteria. Don't ask my president about the budgetary implications of that, because we did spend a lot of financial aid in this very competitive environment to attract those students. But it's hard to disagree with much of what Kyle said. Some law schools are taking considerable risks with the students that they are admitting. There is at some point on LSAT and GPA as predictors of law school performance and passing the bar where the risk is really untoward.
Why are they taking considerable risks? Why would they accept someone who really didn't have the qualifications to do well in law school and to pass the bar?
Well, I think, again, we're in a really interesting moment in legal education. So in 2004, about 100,000 students applied to law school. And in the cycle that we just completed, 53,000-ish applied. So that's a striking
almost
difference.
Half.
Almost half. Several years ago, law schools actually had in their first year classes 52,000 students, which was, in my opinion, way too many. This year, I think it'll be around 37,000. So that's a suggestion that lots of schools are being responsible in who they admit. But there are some schools, because I think of their competitive situation, that are really taking some chances that are untoward.
Is that because they need the money? I mean, if someone is going to your law school, they're paying tuition. Is it about money?
It's about trying to weather the storm and stay in the marketplace, hoping that the market for legal education at some point improves, I think. So, you know, we try to educate our students well. We try to get them good jobs when they graduate in fields that they're interested in. But it is also a business school by school. And most schools are from a budgetary standpoint, driven by tuition. Mm.
Jordan, let me get you in on the conversation. Is the legal profession in trouble here?
I think it's hard to – it's early to say whether or not the legal profession itself is in trouble. There have always been bad lawyers. There have always been lawyers who had trouble passing the bar and have turned out to be pretty good attorneys. You know, one thing not to lose sight here is your LSAT score and your – whether or not you pass the bar aren't necessarily a great predictor of whether or not you will be a good lawyer. Mm. The reason the passing the bar is so important is it's required to be a lawyer in almost every state. There are a few exceptions. So that's why people are making such a big deal about this. It's that, you know, the one thing a law school is supposed to be able to prepare its students to do is pass the licensing exam. In fact, the ABA says so much. You are not supposed to admit a student who you do not think is capable of passing. No, just full stop. There's a non-exploitation rule. The issue here is that there's no real consensus on how low is too low for LSAT and GPA. As Kyle said, there's been some evidence suggesting there's a correlation between your LSAT score and your ability to pass the bar, but there's no magic number that everyone has agreed on. In Kyle's study, he picks 150 out. He uses the figure 150. That's right. Sort of the benchmark for what's too high, or for where below that is too low. There are people who would probably disagree with that. I think it's a pretty reasonable number for various reasons, but it's not as if this is something that everybody will readily agree to in the legal academy. And I think one of the big issues right now is that there isn't a lot of transparency about this relationship, about what happens to students who come in with certain qualifications. And we really need to have more of that in the legal academy. And it would help if the schools that are doing the right thing, that are admitting, continuing to try to admit the high-quality students they think will be able to pass, were more forthcoming with their own data and put pressure on the lower-quality schools that are possibly being predatory in this situation.
And Kyle, I want you to get in on this, but let me just read what that accreditation rule says just so that everyone understands. And this is from the American Bar Association. A law school shall not admit an applicant who does not appear capable of satisfactorily completing its program of legal education and being admitted to the bar. Kyle, let me go to you, because Jordan was saying, you know, is the goal passing the bar, or is the goal to be a good lawyer, or is that one and the same?
Well, they're not one and the same, except, as Jordan said, that actually passing the bar exam is required to be a good lawyer in almost every state. And so it's something schools need to worry about doing. And they need to do both things. They need to ensure that the people that they're bringing in, that they can train them and prepare them to practice law, but also that they can actually pass the exam.
Go ahead. You want to weigh in on this as well, Roger?
So as my faculty is constantly annoyed when I say I live by anecdote and cliche, the cliche that applies here is the devil is in the details. So just to give your listeners the context on particularly LSAT, the test is actually designed to have the 50th percentile of takers score 150.
It's designed for that.
Designed that. It's actually because students now go to prep courses and the like, the scores are actually a little bit higher than that. So the median is right around 151 plus or minus. So I think again, in the devil being in the details, I think most legal educators would say that a student with a 150 LSAT and a decent GPA and the grit to do law school will pass the bar. There's a point below that where the correlation becomes much more scary about whether a particular student will pass the bar. The LSAT actually is designed only to predict how students are going to do in their first year of law school. But, you know, many of us have studied exactly the question in our own schools, what Kyle presented, where with our curriculum and a student's entry credentials, is the student going to be in trouble if he or she runs through our program?
It's interesting to me that you use the word grit. Yeah, you need to have these numbers, but you need grit. And if we're talking about who gets accepted to law school, and perhaps you didn't go to a great high school or college, so you don't necessarily have the kind of preparation from other people that might have gotten a quote-unquote better education, you know, how do you get to that grit if that's important for making it through law school and probably making it to be a lawyer as well?
So the advice I give young people, and I do counsel a lot of young people, hopefully objectively, is actually to take a year or two or more off between college and law school if they have that as a possibility, because then when they come back to school, as I tell them, it's just school.
All right.
And it's a lot easier than the work world, and they know what they need to do to get the job done. There's obviously some people like me who went to law school right after college as
a
21-year-old who did very well.
Grit
is a very important aspect of success in legal education. What every law dean would tell you is the best correlation to bar performance is the GPA of a student in his or her law school. And we have that data. We study that every year. We know exactly what students are at risk on the bar exams our students take. But it comes from their performance in law school. And our correlations actually are not very strong as we've studied it between GPA and LSAT and performance on the bar. But it's to give Kyle his due, it's because our students, almost all of our students, are above the numbers that he's talking about.
Well, there's much more that I do want to talk about, but we need to first take a very short break. And talking about law school and whether law schools have lowered their standards in order to keep their numbers up, talking with Jordan Weissman, he's Slate Senior Business and Economics Correspondent, Roger Dennis, founding dean of the Thomas R. Klein School of Law at Drexel University here in Philadelphia, and Kyle McEntee, co-founder of Law School Transparency, also the executive director. They came out with a report pretty recently, and it's raised a whole host of questions about who's being accepted and whether law schools are accepting too many at-risk students. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about a new report released by the nonprofit group Law School Transparency, saying that average GPAs and LSAT scores of those applying to law school are on the decline. We're talking about what those numbers say and the implications. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Jordan, I know you have to leave us at about 10:30. What I saw as a result of this report that came out were headlines that said, "Dumb Lawyers." Is that how we should think about this?
It's a little premature to say dumb lawyers. Again, the concern is right now is that law schools are taking in too many people who won't pass the bar. By definition, they won't become lawyers. Or I think even beyond that, that law schools might be taking in more people who are just going to drop out, that are not going, you know, retention rates aren't something that are discussed often in terms of law school, but there are institutions where 30% of kids drop out in there. I shouldn't say kids. 30% of students drop out after their first year or within their first year. There aren't a ton like that. That's sort of the really awful end of the legal academy. But I think this is more a concern right now about I think right now everyone should be a little bit more concerned for the law students who may be getting in over their heads, not so much the clients who are going to be saddled with a quote dumb lawyer at this point. I mean, maybe that's what we're going to see happen, but I find that that's not where my attention is at the moment.
Well, Kyle, let me pick up on that, and I also like to get Roger back in on this. Does that raise then questions about perhaps law schools teaching law differently? If it's a different pool of students, and perhaps they have hidden talents that don't come up with a LSAT score or GPA, does it mean that law schools should teach differently somehow to this pool of students?
It might, but that's a really fundamental question about what these law schools want to accomplish. Do they want to accomplish just preparing people to pass the bar, or would they rather have a cohort that they can turn into great, effective lawyers? And I think those are decisions that the schools that are taking the greatest risks are facing right now.
And not you have to necessarily name names, but who are the schools or what kinds of schools are taking the greatest risk, Kyle?
I mean, it's, of course, the for-profit law schools on one end, but that's only six law schools. There are 74 schools in total that we're concerned about. And really, of that group, we're really more concerned with 45 or 46 of them. And so it's a range of public and private schools and schools that have good regional reputations that have just come on hard times and decided, we want to stay open. We have to have money to stay open. So we're going to take greater risk and deal with the fallout later.
Because what you say in this report as well is that law schools are really dependent on tuition. And I don't know if that's different from other schools within university settings, but that law schools in particular need tuition money.
They do. They do. And they are, from the evidence I've seen, more dependent on tuition than virtually any other program out there.
Well, I have to give Roger a chance. He's been nodding no to both things that our other guests have been saying. Go ahead, Roger.
Law schools really are no different on that equation, but the point is a fair one, that law schools are also businesses and they need a number of students to stay in business. Law schools that are embedded in universities that aren't freestanding, many of them, including mine, are getting significant subsidies from central administrations because we think we add a lot of other value to the university. So, and universities have worked that way since they were invented, that programs cross-subsidize each other, that the art history and philosophy department maybe gets some of its funding because a university has a very good business school that makes
a lot
of money. That just goes on. And law schools maybe in the 50s and 60s were on the side of supporting the philosophy and art history department. That equation has flipped at many schools to the other side. But the point is a fair one. Law schools need some number of tuition-paying students to sustain their program of legal education.
Jordan, let me go back to you. Actually, you quoted Noah Feldman in a piece that you wrote. He had a column in Bloomberg, actually used to be here in Philadelphia, and was a guest on Radio Times. And one of the things that he said, and I'm quoting here, if all law students were passing the bar, it would be a sign that law schools weren't taking a chance on students at the margin of the capacity to succeed. And he's sounds like a bit of an outlier on this. He even calls law schools paternalistic, you know, saying that they're going to decide rather than giving perhaps naive students the chance of going to law school and maybe even, you know, failing out and not passing the bar. You want to expand on that at all?
Yeah, I mean, it would be a little bit more credible coming from him if law professor salaries weren't paid by these students' tuition. It's awfully self-serving when it's like, no, we need to take a chance on all these kids. I mean, I think he's a professor at Harvard. He's so removed from the reality of this day to day.
Because he's a professor at Harvard?
Yeah, I mean, Harvard doesn't have this problem. Let's be honest,
okay.
Right? I mean, we're not talking about an issue at Harvard. We're talking about an issue at schools like Cooley Law and Thomas Jefferson. We're talking about the bottom, again, third of the market at most, maybe even less. But the bottom line is that nobody is saying every student needs to pass the bar. You know, if that were the standard, yes, it would probably be an issue. You would see a massive drop in, for instance, in minority enrollment almost surely, because a lot of minority students who are admitted to law school have a lower bar passage rate and lower LSATs. But what people want to see are just better standards, better and more transparent standards, just you know, making it harder for this few schools that really are acting in a predatory manner and just taking whoever's money they can find, whoever's willing to pay tuition, stop them from, you know, again, taking advantage of people who might not know better. And again, that might mean right now the bar passage rate is, I think, about 70-75% off the top of my head, or required bar passage rate. It's, it's in that range. Getting it up to somewhere around 80%, just, you know, making sure that it's a little, there's a little less room for schools to kind of fudge the numbers for who, how many of the students are actually passing the bar. It's not a, no one's asking for a 100% effectiveness rating, you know, for,
just higher than,
for success every time.
Well, let me turn to you, Roger. I mean, does this require the American Bar Association and other bodies to step up and perhaps police the acceptance of students at risk?
So there is an accreditation standard on bar passage that exists now, written by lawyers. It's pretty complicated. It has three different triggers. One is in 3 of 5 years, 75% of your students must pass the bar from the cohort graduating in a single year. Then there's another five-year test. 75% of your students must pass the bar within a five-year period, over that five-year period. And then the third one, and this is where I think there is some considerable controversy, you're also okay if you're within 15% of the first-time pass rate in of ABA students in your jurisdiction.
So what does that mean?
In Pennsylvania, this time the bar pass rate was 80%, a little bit right around that. And so a school that had a 65% pass rate actually would be in compliance with the ABA rule. And I think some people would argue that that is too low. But one of the issues that the ABA faces in establishing this standard is exactly what was raised, is where do you draw the line between an appropriate pass rate and issues around, which are still very serious and troubling, around diversity in the profession. And as a regulator, every time we've looked at this issue, and we have looked at it two or three times in the last 5 years, lots of controversy has come up from people who've been more concerned about the diversity implications of the accreditation standard than on it being too loose.
Ah, interesting. Jordan, you have to leave us. Any final words before we say goodbye?
No, I would just say one of the things about the accreditation standards that I think speaks volumes about how effective they are is that no one has ever lost accreditation over no one has ever lost full accreditation over having too low a bar passage rate. Now, you could say that that's a sign that every law school has been doing a fabulous job, or it's a sign that they don't actually really do, you know, they don't really enforce, the enforcement mechanism is a little bit weak, the standards are too low. You know, again, maybe extending Noah Feldman's logic, it would be a bad sign. Maybe it's a bad sign that everyone is passing the standard. I guess that's my
parting
thought.
Well, that's great. Jordan Weissman, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. It was wonderful discussing this with all of you.
Thank you so much. And he's Slate's senior business and economics correspondent, also one of the hosts of the weekly weekly podcast called Slate Money. Roger Dennis staying with us for the rest of the hour, founding dean of the Thomas R. Klein School of Law at Drexel University. He's also on the Council of the American Bar Association section of legal education and admissions to the bar. And Kyle McEntee, co-founder and now executive director of the law school Transparency. And they did come out with a report not so long ago questioning the standards for acceptance into law school, raising a whole host of questions about whether students are being exploited and what universities and law schools can do to address this issue. 1-888-477-9499. Let me just go back to you very quickly, Kyle, and then I do want to get to some callers. We've got a lot of comments here as well. Your group is called Transparency. transparency. I mean, how much more transparency is needed?
A little more transparency is needed here, but the more important thing is application of the standard you mentioned earlier, which is the non-exploitation standard. And I think if the ABA were to do that, we would solve a lot of the problems. And insofar that transparency can help kind of inform policymakers and regulators, mm-hmm. it would be helpful, but that's not our main goal right now. It's the enforcement of the non-exploitation standard.
And when you say exploitation, you're saying that law schools are knowingly accepting people that they will not be able to make it either through law school, they'll not be able to pass the bar, but they will come with tuition money and that they need the money. Is that what you're saying?
Right. And they end up paying a higher price because they subsidize their peers who are more likely to pass the bar, get a law job, et cetera.
Is that fraud?
Fraud is – it's a legal term. So
it is.
I don't
and
know
you're a lawyer.
Using that.
You don't like using Indeed. That? I mean what? Just goes too far?
It's not that it goes too far. I just haven't analyzed it yet.
Okay. Fair enough. Is it fraud from your perspective looking at you, Roger?
So it's the issue actually, again, to come back to Kyle's report, which technically I think was very well done. Kudos to Kyle.
Thank you.
Is where the line is drawn, the devil being in the details. And I think one of the things the ABA is considering now actually is a transparency regulation to have schools say a bit more. We have to disclose our bar passage rates already, but say a little bit more about the students who don't pass the bar. And that would help students evaluate if this is the right law school for them with the credentials that they have. A piece of it, I can't really talk because I am a regulator in this about specific schools, but a piece of it that is an ongoing response by the ABA is we look at this data every year, and there are triggers, and if schools hit certain triggers of trouble, we're in dialogue with them, and if the dialogue is not going well, we will actually send in a special site evaluator to see what's going on in the school to see if they really are in trouble.
I mean, could they lose their accreditation?
They could be put on probation. That's the first step. And if they're not, if they don't fix the problem, then they would lose their accreditation.
Part of the problem is that the ABA hasn't enforced at least Standard 501, that non-exploitation standard. So they may send people in. They may point out, we're not too happy with what you're doing, but they're not publicly sanctioning them, and that's what needs to happen.
Public, which is naming and shaming, is that what you mean, Kyle?
Exactly.
You know, I'm sure you have something to say, Roger. Let me get Shane from Baltimore to join us because this is very much what we're talking about. Shane, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm actually a Philadelphia native. I moved down here for law school. I'm in my third year now. And I wanted to call and say that I think one of the big things that is very important is making sure that you don't prevent students coming into law school that, like myself, I had poor grades pretty much from middle school forward. I was always kind of a problem student. And by the time I got to college, I sort of leveled out. And my law school took a gamble on admitting me. I'm in my third year now. I've got a great clerkship. I work at the state's attorney's office. I'm applying for judicial clerkships. Law school really turned my life around, and I think it's important moving forward to make sure that we don't prevent people like myself from making that gamble by placing too many barriers or making it seem unsurmountable to sort of change your life by going to law school.
Well, Shane, I really appreciate your call to Radio Times. Let me toss that first to Roger. Well, I mean, I think Shane makes a really good point here. And sometimes you don't know, right?
That's actually true on an individual basis. The caller, I think, demonstrates exactly the point I was talking about a little while ago with you, is law school performance has a lot to do with effort and grit and commitment. But there are clearly some students, when you look at it in the aggregate, who oughtn't be going to law school. And And the issue we're discussing here is lawmaking in action. Where is the right line to be drawn between appropriate risk to keep the doors open for people who really want to work hard and perform well, to keep the bar diverse, which is very important in lawmaking in our society, and where is it actually exploitive?
And Kyle, I mean, here's Shane. He's saying, you know, he probably wouldn't fit the criteria that you've been talking about, but it sounds like he's doing really well in law school. How do you factor someone like him in?
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to the difference between the individuals who have the grit and end up succeeding and the larger group and their weaker predictors. And it comes down to a balance between opportunity and consumer protection. And when you're making this determination, it's not based on anecdotes. It's based on the larger cohort group. And we're only in this situation because law school costs so much money. I think law schools should take risks, but they should not increase the risks for those who are at risk. And that's what it comes down to. It's the law schools have put themselves in this position to not take risks anymore because they're so expensive.
And we're almost up in a break here. I mean, there are predictors and then there are people like Shane, right, who sort of defy predictions.
Right, right. And, you know, I hope he does well in the bar. I hope he gets his clerkship and succeeds. And I want that for everyone. And I would like to see a greater commitment from the Legal Academy on helping those who are at risk get through school and mitigate those risks a bit through shifting financial aid resources to them instead of their highest achievers.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Kyle McEntee, co-founder and executive director of Law School Transparency. Also with us, Roger Dennis, and he's founding dean of the Thomas R. Klein School of Law at Drexel University here in Philadelphia. And we are talking about whether law schools are lowering their standards, lowering the bar, so to speak, of who gets accepted into law school. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Roger Dennis and Kyle McEntee, and again taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Kim from, looks like, Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. And Kim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hello, Marty.
Hi there.
Thank you for having this conversation.
You're welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay. So I just wanted to weigh in and maybe offer the perspective of an employer. In full disclosure, I do run the diversity and inclusion programming for a major law firm, which happens to be headquartered in Philadelphia, but of course has offices all throughout the country, Canada, and Europe. And I just thought it might be helpful to hear maybe a perspective from a legal employer standpoint.
Sure, go ahead.
So I think from my standpoint, we spend a lot of resources. Obviously, we are limited in what we can do because we are often, you know, focused on who's in the law school, who's in the law school population. Obviously, will dictate who ultimately will become a lawyer, and obviously, from my perspective, who we would hire to work in my organization. But I think that I don't want to de-emphasize, the import of LSAT scores and what it may mean for law schools. But I must say, from an employer standpoint, we're not looking at LSAT scores at all.
Oh, interesting.
It has absolutely no bearing whatsoever from our standpoint on whether someone will be hired or not. We are looking at GPA and a multitude of other factors. And frankly, we are making these assessments well before the student will sit for the bar. When we are hiring somebody and we are assessing really their ability to become a good lawyer, and this might highlight maybe some of the tension that might exist between employers and certain law schools. To the extent that we have concerns with law schools, it is really about our law schools preparing their students to practice. You'll hear a complaint often in the legal circles that a lot of the law students don't know how to write. They don't know how to interact with a client in a way that we think will sustain a relationship. They don't have the social skills, for example. Those are some of the complaints that some of us are saying. So we already take it upon ourselves, and we know that we're going to have to invest in training a student to be able to ultimately practice law as an attorney. So I think from my perspective, particularly in diversity and inclusion, because we know we are going to have to do a lot of work. And we are going to invest in that person before they sit for the bar. Mm-hmm. And we will, in many cases, pay for them to take the courses to pass the bar. More of our concern is if you implement these type of gatekeeping mechanisms, that we will not have the ability to have the type of workforce, the diverse pipeline that we will need to ensure that we have the best and most representative population of lawyers able to meet our diverse client needs.
Well, Kim, you raise some really important points, and it's nice to have to hear from someone who employs lawyers. Kyle, let me give you a chance to weigh in on that. And it sounds, at least at her firm, they do a lot of work with students even before they graduate. And it's about training more than LSATs and even the bar.
Well, the students we're concerned about don't have a shot at being hired at Kim's firm. So we're talking about a completely different population here. The other element of this is the diversity issue. And as a profession, we have a major, major, major diversity problem. But we don't solve that diversity problem by admitting more people who have diverse backgrounds who end up with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt and unable to pass the bar. And so what Kim relies on when she is hiring is the law school GPA, which is a better predictor of your ability to pass the bar. But before law school, we don't have access to law school GPA. We only have access to the LSAT and GPA.
Hmm.
And so that's why there's so much discussion on that. And although employers don't use that because they're more concerned with the sorting that happens within a school. But at the large firms that have offices in multiple cities around the country, they're except for Penn, they're not looking at more than the top 10 or 15% of graduates at any of these schools in Philly or within Pennsylvania.
Interesting, and this is a side issue that Kim talks about, developing social skills. And I wonder, Roger, since you're the dean of a law school here in Philadelphia, how is that something that law schools now have to take up or have to take up?
Absolutely. We appreciate that our students are graduating into an incredibly competitive environment. So we have a professional practice requirement for graduation where students have to either participate in an intensive clinical experience or a co-op, which is externship on steroids, where students are embedded with a legal employer almost full-time for a whole term. And that really enables them to understand when they graduate what the requirements of an employer are with respect to both the technical and social side of the practice of law. And I think our students often find out from these experiences as much what they don't want to do as what they want to do.
Very
and that,
important
makes
to know
the,
that
makes the transition to practice a whole lot easier. I like to toot my own horn, but I don't think we're extraordinarily unique. Most law schools have some significant commitment to experiential education today. I would say we're on the outer bounds of that. But, you know, competition has driven change there pretty hard because we are responding to the Kims of the world to produce graduates that all kinds of legal employers want to hire.
Kim, thanks for the call. Kyla, a comment from Hal who says, can they talk about how the lower tier schools are faring? Aren't these the ones who accept potentially unqualified students? And you sort of referenced that, but I just want to give you a chance to respond to that directly.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. The group of schools that we're worried about, it's not the Drexels of the world. It's not Penn. It's not Temple. It's a bunch of other schools that across the country are generally referred to as lower tiered. And they're the ones that are facing the greatest enrollment crunch and therefore budget crunch. And those are the ones that are taking the exploitative risks.
I'm looking at an article in the Wall Street Journal from just a month or so ago. Last week, U.S. District Judge in Florida, quoting an earlier decision, tossed a suit against New York law schools, saying prospective students at Florida Coastal School of Law are a sophisticated subset of education consumers capable of sifting through data and weighing alternatives. They were essentially suing the law school, I guess, for hoodwinking
for deceptive employment data.
But the, a court did not hold that up. Is that important for our discussion, Kyle?
No, I don't think so, because we're a profession, and as a profession, we have ethical obligations to both the people we serve in the public as well as the people we want to bring into the profession to be a better profession, be a more diverse and well-equipped profession. And so the legal question of whether there was fraud or misleading, deceptive information, it's interesting. It's academic, though. Mm-hmm. And looking forward, we have to wonder, are we doing the best job we can as a profession to be better? And we're self-regulating, and we will lose that ability to self-regulate if we keep having law schools chipping away at the trust that lawyers depend on to execute and ensure access to justice and ensure that we have the rule of law. And that's essential for any functioning democracy. And that's kind of the stakes we're dealing with here.
Roger, we began and you talked about the drop-off in the numbers of people applying to law school really cut in half in the last 10 or 12 years. Why don't more people want to go to law school? Is it there aren't jobs out there? Or there's something about the law profession that's not appealing anymore?
Well, I want to actually congratulate Kyle as part of that story. We as legal educators as a whole probably were not as candid as we should have been about outcomes. And that meant some number of students were applying and going to law school without the right information about their job prospects upon graduation. And Law School Transparency and others really pressed legal educators to change our practices in this regard. And so law today actually is the academic discipline that has the best data on the short-term outcomes of its graduates. We know 9 months after graduation what every single one of our students is doing and where they're doing it. And we're subject to audit actually by the ABA on that issue. So, and we just have to disclose tons and tons of information on job outcomes.
Why don't people want to go to law
school? That data really changed, I think, the perception of some number of applicants. And I'm an antitrust lawyer. Markets work. And so some number of students, potential applicants, decided with perfect information on outcomes, law school was not for them. And that's a good thing, because at 37,000 students graduating from American law schools, there's much better alignment between jobs available and students graduating.
Do you agree with that, Kyle?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
He nailed it. Yeah.
He nailed it. Okay. Here's a comment from Phil, just picking up. He says, do they think the portrayal of lawyers in popular culture have influenced people to apply to law school? Has this led to any unqualified applicants? I mean, we did actually a show years ago about lawyer stereotypes. But do you think, Kyle, that's had an impact or not?
I'm not sure it's had an impact, but I think it's a really important problem. As a profession, we want to match people in it that are best suited to take advantage of their personal experiences and their considerable skill and help clients, get the best service that they can. And having them understand what the practice of law is actually like is incredibly important.
Let me get Steve from, looks like Westchester, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Just a comment. It strikes me that the crux of what your speakers are talking about is the quality or the talent level of the people applying to law school. And one way to open that up and increase that level would be to open up the American legal labor market to foreign nationals. And specifically what I'm thinking about is, wouldn't it make sense to apply essentially the H-1B visa program like they do in science and technology to the field of law and allow foreign nationals to apply to our American law schools with essentially a guarantee of at least the ability of applying for an American legal law lawyer position once they complete their education?
Steve, let me toss that to Kyle and see what he says. Have you thought about that, Kyle?
I have not, but we're always looking for new ideas about how to enhance the market for employers and ultimately to help clients. But I think what we're dealing with is we still have to be concerned about how we train the people in the country who want to help their communities and put them in positions to succeed.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Roger?
Well, we do recruit JD students worldwide. I get a little inside baseball on the way accreditation of law schools work. We are allowed to admit students who've graduated from a foreign law school, and then they can get their American JD in 2 years of education rather than three. And we, like a handful of other schools, are now recruiting worldwide to attract some very excellent students from foreign law schools who may stay here in the United States to practice, but more likely will go back home where an American JD is an extremely valuable job credential.
Let me get Mick from Doylestown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Mick. Go ahead. You're in the air.
I graduated from law school 3 years ago. I went relatively late in life. In my experience, schools were not meeting in person with candidates, and it was a crashingly abstract process. My scores were very poor, LSATs and undergrad, but based on my life experience and my writing ability, I believe I was able to get in. I think if the schools were interviewing candidates with low scores, they might be able to better ascertain which ones had the mettle to make it through law school and which ones don't. I'm just wondering how many schools have a policy of interviewing.
Mick, I'm curious, do you have a job? As you said, you're 3 years out of law school. Are you working?
Yes, I am. I'm 3 years out, and I'm working and a happy solo practitioner and passed the bar in Pennsylvania and New Jersey on the first try. But on paper, I was a very poor-looking candidate, I must say, and I always wished I could meet with someone at the school in order to interview because I thought I would have had the benefit of that.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I'm looking at you, Roger, since you run a law school here in Philly. People apply without an interview? Is that
We interview less than half of our students tell you our practice. My alma mater, Northwestern, I think is the only law school that interviews every single candidate. Obviously, again, there's an expense connected to that, and you know, particularly for you know, students who are you know, in Kansas or California,
have to fly in or something like that.
We have to go to them, so it's a really interesting administration problem. But the students we try to interview actually are the students that are on our cusp to get a sense of who they are and whether they're a right fit for us.
We're just about out of time, Kyle. I'm looking at something you wrote. Three basic principles must guide law school choices. Don't produce too many graduates. Don't raise prices because people will eagerly pay. Provide a quality education that enables bar passage and the successful practice of law. Does that pretty much summarize what we've been talking about in this hour?
I think it does.
Well, we're going to end on that note then. Kyle McEntee, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Co-founder of Law School Transparency, where he is now executive director. Roger Dennis, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times as well. You're welcome. A founding dean of the Thomas R. Klein School of Law here at Drexel University in Philadelphia. Also with us, Jordan Weissman. He began our conversation, and he's Slate's senior business and economics correspondent. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Many people that wanted to be part of this conversation, we can carry that on our Facebook page. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and I almost forgot who I was. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we're going to take a very short break, come back with Hour 2. Stay with us. We'll be right back.